Gerard Schwartz and the Scottish Chamber Orchestra having some fun with the Symphony No. 21 by Joseph Haydn.
Good morning. This is WHFR Dearborn, the station making waves, and we are about to enter the second week of the month for the new forum show. This is the Sierra Club Radio program, and there will be two 30-minute episodes right here on WHFR Dearborn right now. Seems to be a little technical delay, so we'll go back to classical for just a moment.
24.
Welcome to Sierra Club Radio, a weekly show of green news you can use. Now, here's your host, Orly Cotell.
Welcome to Sierra Club Radio. On today's show, we'll talk with the governor of Wisconsin, Governor Jim Doyle. We'll also get some green living tips from Josie Garthwaite, and Daniel Sherwood will give us the inside look at plug-in hybrid cars.
We're here now with the governor of Wisconsin, Governor Jim Doyle. It's an honor to have you on our show.
Well, thank you, Orly. Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with talking about some of the green initiatives that you've created in Wisconsin. We hear that you've recently appointed a global warming task force, and we'd like to hear more about how you see the state of Wisconsin leading the way.
We had really an extraordinary global warming task force. It had people from industry, from the utilities. It also had environmentalists. It had experts and scientists from our universities. It had citizens who were concerned. So it really was a broad range, and they came up with a very, very strong, but I think very balanced approach to how we reach 25 by 25, which is our goal to have by the year 2025, 25% of our electricity generated by renewables and 25% of our motor vehicle fuel also coming from renewables. It is a plan that calls for sharp increases in the use of biomass in Wisconsin, where we have great farm production. We also have great forests. It is very heavily directed towards investments in research and in investments in startup companies that are innovative in the area of renewable energy and conservation. It is one that I think took a very broad and realistic look at what the situation was. One of the co-chairs is Tia Nelson, the daughter of Gaylord Nelson, the founder of Earth Day and one of our great environmentalists. This is the state where John Muir grew up and Aldo Leopold did his first work and where Gaylord Nelson was from. So we have a very proud tradition to hold up.
We hear that you also announced grants for clean energy, wind, and solar power. Tell us more about how that will work.
Well, we did. We will be putting out grants that will total about $150 million in the coming years. The first round of them went out, and if you look at the roster of the companies that we gave grants and no-interest loans to, you can see the kind of innovation that is out there. A company that is developing a window shield that not only helps block out the light, but actually generates heat, and it can be converted into power without any loss of visuality through the window. To companies that are very much at work and pretty well down the line on developing ethanol from various sugars in ways of with great potency that can actually drive our cars in a green way. The whole range of these kinds of really inventive, entrepreneurial efforts that I think are going to, in Wisconsin, we've had a very, very strong biotech and growing biotech. This is where stem cell research began. And I want us to see to have that same kind of research profile in the area of green energy.
Let's talk a little bit about coal. We know you took a strong position against state agencies relying on coal for heating and cooling their facilities. Do we need to phase out the use of coal in Wisconsin?
Well, to be very practical about it, I think it's unlikely you are going to phase out coal in Wisconsin, because just historically, the way the world has worked, we are a 70% coal-using state. And so, to me, we are closing a couple of coal-powered state plants and moving to other sources of energy. But I also think we really have to be directed in a state like Wisconsin at clean coal. We have worked with the Midwest governors, signed really historic accords, and one of them was for us to be planning a carbon-free infrastructure, so that if coal is to be used and carbon is to be captured and sequestered, we understand that takes a large infrastructure. And it isn't just going to be one state that can do it. So, I think we all really want to make sure that we are sharply reducing the amount of carbon going into the air. That means doing something very significant with coal. On a very practical terms, though, in Wisconsin, when you have a state that, you know, over the decades and a century and a half now has been such a coal state, we really are going to have to get the researchers hard at work and get the federal government as well as state governments involved in major investments in how you have clean coal technology.
Now, in Kansas, the governor asked the Department of Natural Resources to regulate carbon dioxide. And I know that several years ago, some citizens petitioned the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources to also regulate carbon dioxide. Is that something that you would do in Wisconsin?
Well, I think so, except let me say, I think the best way that we're going to regulate carbon dioxide is by having a true cost for carbon. And what we have been working towards is really capping and trading carbon credits as a way that you bring, and this is the way our Green Energy Task Force approached it, that we're going to set very ambitious goals for reducing the amount of carbon going in. And that, as we have done in the Clean Air Act, we would work through credits. I believe strongly the United States has to enter into an international carbon market and be signatories to Kyoto or whatever the next generation of Kyoto is. In Wisconsin, we're one of only three states that has actually signed accords with the UK to exchange information and technology and set the stage for our participation in it. So I believe that the way that you bring carbon down is that you, it's the only way to do it, is that you have to put a cost on that carbon that's going into the air, and you have to set aggressive goals over the next 25 years to really reduce the amount of carbon going into the air. So I'm a strong proponent. The Midwest governors have agreed on a cap and trade program, and we are actually at work today and hope within the next several months are going to announce the plans for it. In the long run, it's not going to be a regional market, I don't believe. It has to be a national and international market.
Now, shifting gears a little bit, you are the chairman of the Great Lakes Council. Talk to us about efforts to protect the Great Lakes.
Well, we've seen some real successes in the last few months. we have we worked to get the Great Lakes Compact passed, which it passed the legislatures of all eight Great Lakes states, and now has to go to Congress for ratification. It was passed last month unanimously by the United States Senate, and we believe it'll be passed this fall by the House of Representatives. What it does is two things. One is it protects the Great Lakes from the diversion of water out of the Great Lakes Basin. Over 20% of the world's fresh water is in the Great Lakes. If you spread the Great Lakes out over the 48 continental United States, the water would be 9.5 feet deep. That's how much water there is there. It is a tremendously important ecosystem for the whole world, and the compact will protect that against diversions of the water. The second thing the compact does is for the first time set up the framework for states together to manage the waters of the Great Lakes. Right now, for example, Lake Michigan is between Michigan and Wisconsin, and the state line is halfway down the lake. So we do our management, they do theirs. The Great Lakes Compact will allow us to, as states, really work together. We have enormous challenges: invasive species, outdated water treatment and sewage plants, loss of habitat, serious damage to the fisheries. All of this is going to call for a major new initiative. And let me just say, I'm very pleased to say that just within the last couple of days, Barack Obama has announced his support for $5 billion to jumpstart the Great Lakes collaboration to really help to restore the waters of the Great Lakes.
Now, Wisconsin has become a very important state for the upcoming election. I'm curious, what do you think are the specific energy and environmental issues that Wisconsin voters find important?
There is no doubt in Wisconsin people understand very significantly our need to get off of the foreign oil addiction. They also understand something we've worked very hard on in the state, that we have the opportunity to really build a major part of our economy around green energy. So people in Wisconsin, I believe, are looking for a strong leader who is really ready to make this a national mission to move us to an independent and green energy future. We, in Wisconsin, I think people really do understand that this isn't only about multiple PhD researchers, who we love and who will unlock a lot of the scientific secrets that are going to help us move towards green and independent energy. But it also means that we're going to need sheet metal workers and construction workers and farmers and foresters. We're going to need business people. We're going to need the whole range of people to build a green economy. Wisconsin, given our agricultural resources, our forest resources, and our great, great research capacity here. In fact, the University of Wisconsin's recently received a $125 million grant from the Department of Energy to be one of the centers for biofuels, the development of biofuels in this country. It's that research capacity that that will help us move forward. So I think people in Wisconsin really want to see us fully engaged in building a strong and vibrant economy around green and renewable energy.
Anything else you want to add for our listeners?
Well, one final point that sometimes I realize, even as I spoke, I overlook, but it is so important, and there's good business opportunities in it, and that's conservation. In fact, just to mention a couple of companies here, but one of them is Johnson Controls, which much of its business is in helping people save energy. Another really growing company, and this is true in other states, but is one called Orion Lighting in Manitowoc. It's in an old industrial operation that had moved to Mexico, and they moved in, and their business is providing lighting solutions, a lot of it natural light, how to bring natural light into closed buildings to help reduce energy costs. And it's a manufacturing operation. So these two companies, I could go on with the list, I think really demonstrate it's not only in the production of energy, but there are really good jobs to be had in Wisconsin in the conservation of energy as well.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today. It's been an honor to have you on our show. And again, you've been listening to the Governor of Wisconsin, Governor Jim Doyle. We're here now with Josie Garthwaite, the Green Living Editor for Sierra Magazine. Welcome.
Thank you. Today we're going to talk about the low-carbon diet. What are some ways to shrink the environmental impact of our food choices?
Well, I think the best place to start with this is there is no one low-carbon diet. There are many ways to look at this. But with each food choice you make, you can think about four factors. You want to know how it was grown, how it was processed, what is the packaging, and then also the fourth phase to look at with any food product is the transportation. How far did it come from to get to my plate right now? And with most food that you would have in a typical meal, it's coming from 1,500 miles away. That's a long ways, and that's a lot of fuel going into that. That's a lot of pollution coming out of the tailpipe or going into the shipping. So an easy way to reduce the transportation phase is to look at your local food options. So that can be at the farmer's market, that can be at a local store where you can ask them, where did you get this from? And they can say, oh, well, we get all of our things from, you know, Farmer John down the street. But another way that you might be able to reduce the impact of those four phases is looking at organic, because there you can find foods grown with a lot fewer chemicals, and so that can also shrink the impact of the foods. Another way is to look at seasonal produce. So that, again, you know just by going to the farmer's market what's in season, but if you don't have a farmer's market near you, you can also go to a grocery store and try to get things that are in season right now in your region. And you can find out about that by going to the website localharvest.org. They'll tell you what's in season in your region.
What about certain foods that might have higher carbon footprints than other foods? For example, should people be incorporating more vegetables into their diet? What should we be thinking about with that?
Usually, meat involves a much more environmentally intensive process than produce does, because you have to not only raise the animal, but you have to raise the feed for the animal. The vegetables and fruit, that's taking out one of those steps. So I'm not going to tell you become a vegetarian, but you can reduce the impact of your weekly diet just by having more vegetable-centric meals. So maybe giving vegetables more of a starring role in your meal.
Anything else we should know about low-carbon diets?
Something that makes it easier to make this change is being a little more flexible with your recipes. So if you start to look at methods of cooking, for example, if you get really comfortable braising or you get really comfortable grilling things, then you can start to incorporate local and seasonal and organic foods, whatever is most available and affordable to you at a given time.
And how does braising or grilling help make it more carbon neutral?
The actual cooking method doesn't reduce the environmental impact, but having that flexibility so I don't have to follow this recipe that is calling for bell peppers when bell peppers aren't in season, or maybe I don't have peaches grown near where I live, but there's a whole bunch of apricots, so I can swap those in. If I'm comfortable with the cooking methods, then I can use the produce that is the most environmentally friendly choice for where I'm living and the time of year.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today. You've been listening to Josie Garthwaite, the Green Living Editor for Sierra Magazine.
We're here now in the studio with Daniel Sherwood to talk about plug-in hybrids. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So let's talk about how you got started in the plug-in hybrid business. We hear a lot about plug-in hybrids. What made you decide to invest in that field?
Well, I've always been frustrated that the auto manufacturers use the term hybrid to describe a car. You know why it's called hybrid is because it's supposed to be a hybrid between an electric car and a gas car. But when I think of an electric car, I think of a car that I plug into the wall and drives on electricity. And clearly none of the hybrid cars do that. So it's almost a bit of a misnomer to even call it a hybrid gas electric car. So I was very frustrated. You know, if you're going to go to the trouble of putting an electric motor and a battery in a car, why not plug it in, you know? Then I met a man named Felix Kramer that has an organization called CalCars, the California Cars Initiative. And he's working very hard to promote this concept of the plug-in hybrid car. And he actually posted instructions on his website that showed you how you could do it. So I thought that was fantastic. I tried it on my own car.
Did you have a background as a mechanic or anything?
I'm an electrical engineer, and I worked in solar power for a lot of years. So I'm really interested in renewable energy, and I know a lot about, electrical engineering. It definitely helps. Nonetheless, it was surprisingly to me how easy it was to convert my Toyota Prius into a plug-in Prius that lets me drive around town on electricity instead of on gas. And so it was like a eureka moment for me. I'm like, everyone needs to have one of these. And I looked around for where I could buy one, and I couldn't buy one. So this is a market need that needs to be filled.
So you decided to start your own business retrofitting normal Prius motors to be able to be plug-in hybrids.
Yeah. So I started a company. It's called Three Prong Power. It's located in Berkeley. And what we basically do is we take anyone's Toyota Prius and we add a plug to the back of it, a battery charger. We actually add a lot more batteries into the vehicle itself. We don't mess with the Toyota drivetrain at all. We don't change the electric motor. We don't change the engine. Most of the car stays exactly like it is, except it has a much larger battery. And like I said, you can now plug it into the wall. And just by doing that, we're able to get a car that works as an electric car for in-city driving. And then it works as a regular Prius on the highway if you need to go further than that.
How far can it go just using the electric charge that you would get from the outlet?
So right now with the batteries that we've been using, they're very standard. They're actually electric wheelchair batteries. They're not high technology batteries. They're ubiquitous. They're easy to find, and therefore they're inexpensive. And with those batteries, we can get about 10 to 12 miles of all electric range without using any gas in the car.
Now, don't most people drive more than 10 to 12 miles if they have to get around town?
It depends on the people. For me, even when I worked at the solar company, it was actually about a 7-mile commute to my work and a 7-mile commute home, which normally would put me outside of the range of the car. But if you can plug in at work, you can actually charge it while you're at working, and then you do have the range to get back home again. So with that kind of commute that I had, I absolutely wouldn't have to use gas at all during the week. Now, obviously, some people need to go further, and there's also a limitation. The car's electric motor is only strong enough to go about 50 miles per hour. So for highway driving, you have to use, you know, some gas. And the answer to that, a lot of people are pointing to newer and better battery technologies. And there's been a lot of talk about a particular technology called lithium phosphate batteries. And we're hoping to have that available as an upgrade very soon, which will extend the range, you know, more like 30 miles range.
But of course, it's not a problem, because if you drive your 12 miles, you have no more, you can't drive any further on the electric motor, then the normal gasoline motor just kicks in and you can drive it like a normal car. It's not like you're going to be stranded on the highway.
That's absolutely true. That's the great thing about it, is that there's really no downside. You know, in a regular electric car, once you've gone your range, you're stranded. But this way, you're never stranded. You know, worst case scenario, you fire up the gas engine, it acts like a regular Prius. It just feels like you're driving a regular Prius.
Now, how much does it cost to upgrade one of these cars so that you can plug it into your normal electrical outlet at home and charge it off the grid?
Right now, we charge $6,700 to do the conversion with the lead acid batteries in Berkeley.
And do you find that is paid back over time in terms of people not having gas costs?
It's not a great payback, I'll be honest with you. It depends a little bit on how often you can plug in the car during the day. If you have the driving pattern where you plug it in only at night, when electricity is the least expensive, it's actually a very long payback. To get a better payback, you'd have to do a scenario where you drive it to work, plug it in at work, drive it home, plug it in, go out to dinner, plug it in. You know, then you can get, you know, paybacks that are, you know, within maybe 5 years or less. But otherwise, the payback is a long time. So you're mostly doing it for the right reasons, which is that we use too much oil from foreign countries. And this is the only way that I know. I mean, there's biofuels, for example, but there's not enough biofuels to go around. I used to drive on biodiesel myself. It's getting to the point where restaurants are now charging to take their oil because there's so many people looking for this veggie oil. So you're looking for more alternatives, and there's really nothing else out there that works today except for these plug-in hybrid cars.
Now, how long do you think until these are more widely available?
Well, hopefully, we're going to see the large car companies make these plug-in hybrid cars. And in fact, General Motors just announced last week they had their 100th anniversary event. And really, the keystone of that event was the announcement of the General Motors Volt, which is a car they've been advertising for a long time, but no one has ever seen actually what it looks like until last week. And this is a revolutionary car. If what they say is true, it's going to go 40 miles on all electric range, and it's going to be the first commercially available plug-in hybrid.
So it would also have a gas motor that could kick in.
It has also a gas motor that kicks in, exactly. And they're scheduling that car to be released, they say, at the end of 2010. And I hope that they're right.
So in the meantime, for folks that do want to have a plug-in hybrid, the only real option is to do this sort of upgrade that you propose. Can you do it only with the Toyota Prius, or can you do it with the hybrid Civic or any other hybrid car?
So right now we only do the Toyota Prius. It's by far the most common hybrid car. There's actually more Toyota Priuses than every other hybrid car model combined together on the road. But we are trying to expand our offering to include other models like the Toyota Highlander, the Ford Escape, Lexus series. The Civic hybrid models, for very technical reasons, are a little more difficult to do a conversion with. So we're probably not looking at the Civic hybrid models anytime soon.
So does this void the warranties on the car?
There's a law, and it's called the Magnuson-Moss Warranty Act. And what this law says is that a car manufacturer cannot refuse to honor their warranty unless they can show that what you modified on the car actually caused that damage. So, for example, if we did something wrong and our conversion caused the car's battery or electric motor to be damaged, then Toyota could legitimately say, we're not going to honor that warranty. However, if your air conditioning springs a leak and your air conditioning doesn't work, they absolutely have to fix your air conditioning. Regardless of all that, there's already a million Toyota Priuses on the road, more than 200,000 being sold every year. I think even once these cars begin to become available from the manufacturer, there's going to be a lot of used cars out there, and I think some people will be willing to convert their existing used cars rather than having to buy a brand new car just in order to get the plug-in feature.
Now, when these companies are adding the plug-in feature to their car, if, for example, Toyota decided to add a plug-in feature to their Prius, would that cost the company less than, say, it's costing someone like you to upgrade them just because they can do it right from the start in the manufacturing process?
Yeah, clearly, if Toyota and GM are willing to commit to the volume of cars that they do for their other car lines, then yes, they can make them for much less money than I could, in theory. Again, it remains to be seen how they're going to market it. They might decide to make it an upmarket product, in which case it could be very expensive. And the other thing we don't know is for the GM Volt, they've announced the electric range, but for Toyota, they haven't announced that. So we actually don't know what the electric range in the Toyota is. And their initial test vehicles that they've had, there's actually two in California right now, one at UC Berkeley. It only has, I think, a 7 or 8 mile electric range on it. So it doesn't even have it's not that impressive right now. And they might increase that. But I guess my point is, we got to wait and see what the car companies do. And it's going to be several years away. So for right now, this is our best solution.
Now, one question I hear a lot is about the battery. Some people are concerned that the battery in the hybrid car could be toxic. Disposing of it could be a problem. Is that a question that you ever get asked? And what kind of response do you have?
I think in general, all batteries are very well recycled. The batteries we use are lead acid batteries. There is great infrastructure in place for recycling these batteries because they're very commonly used in all applications. The batteries that Toyota uses now, they're actually a nickel metal hydride battery. It's a little harder to recycle. You basically have to send it back to Toyota. They recycle it for you. The lithium batteries that are coming out now, again, not a lot of infrastructure in place, but in theory, they should be recyclable.
Anything else our listeners should know about why plug-in hybrids are a good solution, what kind of impact they can really make on the planet?
I think the impact is actually going to be huge. A lot of people don't realize this, but electric transportation wins on almost every level. So not only is it a way of not using oil, it also is much better for global warming. Almost a quarter, only 25% of the greenhouse gas emissions compared to gasoline transportation.
Especially
that's
if we can
true.
Green the grid. I mean, California,
absolutely.
We're getting greener power.
In California, we have a very green grid, so we have very green electricity. And if you're on like Pacific Gas and Electric, which is my utility, you can actually pay about $5 a month and get carbon-free electricity. So you can be global warming neutral with this technology, which is fantastic. Second of all, from tailpipe emissions. We have a big problem in California with urban smog, especially in Los Angeles, but also to a lesser extent in the Bay Area. It causes a lot of health effects. And so when you're driving in this electric mode, you have no tailpipe emissions at all. So it's fantastic for urban smog. It's fantastic for global warming. It's an alternative to oil. It's really, a great solution.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today. You've been listening to Daniel Sherwood, who has his own company called Three Prong Power that helps convert hybrid cars to be plug-in hybrid cars. You can visit his website at threeprongpower.com. That's the number 3prongpower.com.
This has been Orly Kotel with Sierra Club Radio. To send us feedback about the show or to ask a question for Mr. Green, you can email us through our website at sierraclubradio.com.
You've been listening to Sierra Club Radio, a weekly program of green news you can use. For more information, visit sierraclubradio.com.
This is WHFR Dearborn, and you're listening to Sierra Club Radio. This is the second week of the month, and that means it's time for the Sierra Club Radio Club. This is a one-hour show made up of two sections from the Sierra Club Radio program, and gives us all sorts of useful and interesting ideas of ways we can make our life better. And we're addressing some interesting environmental issues in these two shows today, so I hope you enjoy that. Stay tuned every Saturday from 10 until 11 for talk and informational program on the WHFR forum. And next week we'll have Mike Holloway, and that will be Metaphysically Speaking, and he talks about things like astrology, other holistic arts, and he also hosts the Blue Show on Tuesdays from 4 until 6. And as we wait for the program to flip over, we'll talk a little bit about the fourth Saturday, and this is a music appreciation course that's starting, and this will be on the fourth Saturday of the month, first one coming up in October, so I hope you enjoy that too. I am Lynn, and I'll be on at 11 o'clock with Light from the Underground, filling in for Bill today, and I'll have a lot of interesting music coming up at that time. So stay tuned for that, and followed by that will be No Boys Allowed. And let's go into, let's flip over to classical for just a moment.
Hermann Baumann was the horn soloist in that concert piece by Camille Saint-Saëns. Kurt Mazur led the Leipzig Gewandhaus Orchestra. We'll take a trip to the West Side in just a minute.
You are listening to WHFR Dearborn, broadcasting out of Henry Ford Community College. Thank you for tuning in on this day. We would love to share the opportunity.
Welcome to Sierra Club Radio, a weekly show of green news you can use. Now, here's your host, Orly Cotell.
Welcome to Sierra Club Radio. On today's show, we're honored to talk with environmental champion Senator Maria Cantwell from Washington State. We'll also speak with John Bela from the Rebar Arts Collective about Parking Day, a project that turns parking spaces into temporary public parks. Josie Garthwaite will give us some green living tips, and Emily Green will talk with us about a big victory to protect the Great Lakes. We're here now with Senator Maria Cantwell of Washington State, the recipient of Sierra Club's Edgar Wayburn Award. Senator Cantwell has been a champion of the environment since she was elected to the Senate in 2000. Her leadership has covered the breadth of environmental issues, including holding polluters accountable for the cleanup of toxic wastes, protecting the Arctic from oil and gas drilling, leading the charge for clean renewable energy, and creating new green jobs. We're honored to have her on our show. Welcome.
Thank you. It's an honor to be on your show.
Well, let's start by talking about what has inspired you to be such a champion for the environment. Did you have a eureka moment at some point, or was it always a part of your life?
Well, I had some great mentors who introduced me to some wonderful places around Washington State, but I think it was working with people like Hazel Wolf and Brock Adams, who were two people that I got to know very well in Washington State, who had great passion and love for the environment. Hazel, many people I'm sure in Sierra Club circles would know her for her work and publishing Outdoor West, and certainly people know Brock Adams for his work in saving the forest.
Well, you've been a big champion in the Senate for renewable tax credits recently. Tell us more about that.
Well, it's very important that we get off of fossil fuel, and the best way to do that is quit incenting fossil fuel. If we can incent green energy, wind, solar, biofuels, giving them tax credits and a more predictable time frame for those tax credits, we can really see these industries provide a big percentage of our power needs for the future. So right now we're trying to really unleash the power of solar by giving them an 8-year tax credit so the predictability of this new technology, particularly in the southwest part of the country, can be developed.
How is that battle shaping up in Congress? I mean, are people supportive in general of this issue, or do we still have the same challenges that we face of the oil industry trying to squash it?
Well, I'm hoping that we will be able to pass this legislation next week. And one of the things we're hopefully going to be able to do is take the money actually away from oil companies, the tax breaks that they're getting, and instead give it to the wind and solar industry. I think that's the appropriate direction. The last energy bill we did probably was 70% continuing to incent fossil fuel and only 25% for renewables. If we pass this bill, I think we'll have the opposite effect, 75% for renewables. That's the direction our country needs to go, and that's what we're trying to get done.
Now, you recently had a hearing about oil speculators. Tell us more about that.
Well, we're very concerned that there are dark markets, that is, that regulators aren't doing their jobs. And so we had oil prices spike to $140 a barrel without any supply disruption. So we've had great concern that the federal regulators aren't overseeing the markets and that money is being poured into these markets, not because they're truly hedge operators like airlines or farmers, but people who are just doing excessive speculation without the proper oversight. So the hearing was very clear that we've seen exorbitant run-up in price, not based on market fundamentals of supply and demand. So we want these dark markets regulated, and we want to change the law.
On another note, some say that we would have lost the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge in 2005 if you hadn't led the fight in the Senate to protect it. So tell us more about why the Arctic is so important, why you took on that particular battle.
Well, the Arctic is an incredible place on our planet. It is an ecosystem intact, and we need to preserve that ecosystem. I look back to people who were in the Senate years ago who made an arrangement to create such a protection, and there is no reason for us to look at drilling in the Arctic Wildlife Refuge. And many of my colleagues on the other side of the aisle tried to promote that concept, and we were very fortunate a few years ago in stopping them from attaching it to a defense authorization bill. They thought there would be no way people could vote against a bill that would have money for the troops, but I think we showed that there was no way we were going to be gamed into believing that we had to start opening up drilling in the Arctic Wildlife Refuge.
So how can we continue to protect our natural treasures in an era where so many people on the right are calling for oil drilling?
Well, I think that when you have people like T. Boone Pickens telling you that oil is not the solution, that renewables are, I think that the American people just need to understand. In 30 years, we opened up drilling in the outer continental shelf. We'd still only get 1% of what we need as far as energy. But instead, if we focused on plug-in hybrids and getting that technology and getting the electricity grid, it could provide enough generation for electric cars for us to reduce our dependence and imports on foreign oil by 50% in that same time period. So on the one hand, drilling 1% of what we need by 2030, an aggressive plan on plug-ins and using the electricity grid, a 50% reduction. So I think we know where we need to go. Let's get about breaking this addiction to oil.
Now, as a former businesswoman who then went into public office, what is the overlap between business and public service? How does that help you? And then also, what kind of role do you see business playing in a new clean energy economy?
Well, these are great new technologies, and people don't understand how available they are today. And not only what the United States could do in transforming our economy to a clean, efficient, energy, renewable economy, but that same leadership, particularly in the area of energy efficiency, could create a whole new platform for the United States to be world leaders in. When I think about the pollution that comes over to the Pacific Northwest from China, I think that not only are we struggling to implement these plans in the Northwest, but to make sure that other countries don't make the same mistakes but are aggressive today about renewables. And so I'm hoping that this green energy economy will be a big boost to the United States.
What do you think should be the three biggest energy priorities for the next Congress?
I think continuing to make the transition to renewables in general, wind and solar. There's opportunity to do that through a renewable portfolio standard. Many states have already adopted. But I think digitizing, getting to have a smart electricity grid so that we can really have distributed generation and power created and put on the grid, and people continue to make achievements like zero homes, where homes aren't even using any net power but are actually putting power back onto the grid. Those kinds of developments could really transform America's energy consumption. And right now, one of the biggest gains we could have in producing a 10% new supply of energy would be to use the energy that we have now more efficiently. That would be a 10% reduction. And that is a big source of energy. And that kind of energy efficiency would come with developing a smart electricity grid.
Now, in your time in Washington, you've taken on some pretty powerful interests and some interesting characters. What inspires you? What keeps you going? What gives you the urge to fight what sometimes feels like an uphill battle?
I think I learned it from my father. He was on the city council in the Midwest, and he was the minority leader and outnumbered. But that didn't stop him every day for getting up and fighting for the things that people in our neighborhood cared about. And I saw him take on some pretty big battles and not blink. And it's given me the courage every day to fight the battles that I fight.
Now, you're one of the only women to unseat an incumbent senator. What's it like to be one of only 16 women senators in Washington these days? Is gender still a big issue, or do you think that we've overcome that in some sense?
We need more women, and we have more work to do there. So I'm hoping that we are able to get more women elected to the Senate. We have a couple of good candidates, Jean Shaheen in New Hampshire and Kay Hagan in North Carolina. So hopefully we will get more, but we have a long way to go. My state has two women senators and a woman governor, so we're kind of leading the nation and having women in high-profile positions.
Of all the work that you've done to protect the environment, what are you the most proud of?
Well, that's a hard question because, you know, we've been able to do other work in helping to designate wild and scenic rivers, expanding Mount Rainier, which is a jewel for us in the Northwest, and being able to expand the park to make sure that it continues to have the same available access to the people who want to visit every year was a big priority. But I have to say, preserving the Arctic Wildlife Refuge, having got to go there about a year after we had the battle, I'd never been there previous to that. And seeing what a special place it really is, and the fact that we came so close to losing it, made me realize that, you know, we have, God has been one great architect, and that we have to continue to preserve those things that last longer than we do. And I think the battle for the Arctic was a one that many, many people were involved in, very historic in its efforts. And continuing that battle, many people had had previous efforts to preserve the Arctic. And so I just feel like we were there at a crucial time when the numbers might have out basically stopped us from preserving it. But I think that that was a great moment that showed that people from all across the country could realize the significance of preserving that unique place.
Anything else you want to add for our listeners?
I think that's it. Oh, we need a good Superfund law, and Barbara Boxer and I have been working on financial assurances, and we need to reform the 1872 mining law. It's way past its time to be updated.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today. Yeah. You've been listening to Senator Maria Cantwell from Washington State. Joining us now in our studio is John Bela from the arts collective called Rebar. Welcome.
Thank you.
It's great to have you back in the studio. I know we had you guys in here last year to talk about Parking Day. And once again, a year has gone by and it's Parking Day has happened again. So let's talk a little bit for our listeners who haven't heard of Parking Day. What's the idea? Where did it come from? And how's it been going?
Well, it's a one-day global event where people temporarily transform parking spots into parks, playgrounds, open spaces for creative expression and play.
And the idea behind this is you can just feed the meter, put quarters in that meter, and then
that's how it
you
started.
On the spot.
That's how it started, yeah. Essentially, we looked at the parking spot as a short-term lease for a space that could be used for whatever you want. And it turns out that in the States in particular, it's undervalued real estate. So by putting a few quarters in the meter, you have a space that you can use for whatever you like. We chose to fill that space with a park to deal with the unmet need for open space in a particular area of San Francisco.
And so is this a legal thing that people can do? Did you have any problems trying to get permits or worrying about people?
Well, we've never gotten a permit. The way we work is we sort of we look at the codes that define urban space as our primary medium. And so before we did the installation, we actually looked in the San Francisco parking code. And it turns out that it's not illegal to put something other than a car in a parking space.
As you feed the meter.
As long as you pay the parking meter, exactly. It turns out that the code is different, of course, in whatever state you're in. But given that the first event was so successful, I think, in effect, we've sort of claimed that territory as a site for creative action. So whereas in New York or other states it may not be technically legal, we're sort of getting ad hoc permission to do this without going through a permit process or anything else.
Well, so let's talk about that, because I know you guys started this event in San Francisco.
That's right.
And it's grown over time. Where was it celebrated this past year? Do you have a sense of how many people created impromptu parks, both in San Francisco and then elsewhere in the country?
Yes. We were actually not here in San Francisco for Parking Day. We were in Amsterdam for another event, or actually bringing Parking Day to Amsterdam. But I heard that there were 50 parks in San Francisco, 50 more in Los Angeles, probably close to 50 or more in New York City, Chicago, Minneapolis, Miami, literally name a state in the country, name a city, and it's likely there's probably a park there.
I saw that the New York Times even editorialized about the issue.
They did, yeah. They had a piece about the conflict over parking spaces in the city. So it's really grown to be not just a national event, but an international event. And part of the way that occurred was that after the first event, we got such an outpouring of interest. And the folks said, hey, could you bring this to our city, to our town, to, you know, demonstrate the need for more urban open space, to think about rethinking the way we use streets, focusing on people places instead of parking spaces. And we couldn't physically go to those locations, but what we could do is share the idea. So we came up with our how-to manual, which really describes in a couple of simple steps, what are the ways that you can transform a parking space to turn it into whatever you want?
And so what are some of the fun things that people did?
This year there was a pirate ship in a parking space. We've seen ping pong. We've seen urban forests. We've seen green roofs. We've seen playgrounds. Last year there was an impromptu health clinic. There was a hair salon. I mean, it's literally across the board. For our park this year, we actually created a piece of modular inflatable furniture called Bushwaffle. And the idea is that, you know, Parking Day, it's more about greening. It's really more about sort of visual greening. It's really about the social ecology of cities. And our concern is that, you know, cities are increasingly sort of constrained and governed by commercial activity. The idea behind a parking spot is that you open the space for non-commercial use as an act of generosity. And it's really about a vital, healthy public realm and a vital social ecology as much as it is about grass.
Now, I passed by a few on the street in San Francisco near my office, and the ones that I passed by really looked like little parks. I mean, they had rolled yeah. out grass, and they had lawn chairs, and people sure. were sitting and eating their lunch. What was really remarkable to me was how quickly that space was transformed. I mean, all yeah. of a sudden, on Mission Street in San Francisco, where there is no green,
yeah.
there was a full-on park. There were about 20 yeah. people squeezed into this little patch of grass eating lunch. What is the larger commentary that you're trying to make about the way that we use space in cities? Are we dedicating too much of it to cars? Is this about funding our parks? Is there a larger political ask?
Well, you know, depending upon who you speak to, I think any of those things are true. From our perspective, it's really about rethinking the way that we use urban space. In San Francisco, 25% of the land area is streets. And whereas in past generations, the streets might accommodate multiple functions, you know, in addition to the movement of vehicles, you would have social space in the street, commerce, you would have places for gatherings and play. And today we've sort of engineered streets such that the primary focus is movement of vehicles and storage of vehicles. But if you think about that land area in the city, it could be the largest piece of public space in the city, but we don't treat it that way. So for us, it's about rethinking the way we use streets and urban space as a social space and about creating people places instead of parking spaces.
When you think about the storage of vehicles, you had mentioned how that real estate is undervalued. How much money is generated by one parking space? I mean, if you could compare that to how much you would have to pay to buy real estate that would take up that much space in this city, I'm sure it's not even comparable.
Yeah, I think that we calculated it would be about $200 a month to rent a parking space. And so, you know, if you're thinking about...
And a studio apartment, which is about the same size, would cost you five times that.
It costs you five times that amount here. So we haven't done the numbers in every city, but overall, you know, parking is undervalued. And that actually creates an incentive. If you look at the work of Donald Shoup at UCLA, he talks about cheap parking creates an incentive for people to drive instead of walking or taking transit. So what you get is a lot of people searching around for that empty parking space, wasting a lot of fuel, clogging up the roads, and really it's an undervaluation of that space.
Have you taken it to the next level in terms of talking with politicians in the city about Parking Day? Is it something that's on the radar screen of our elected officials?
Well, it's really interesting right now. There's a lot of initiatives underway. We in 2006, we began to partner with the Trust for Public Land, which is a national conservation organization who's really focused on green space in our cities and protecting open space in general. So we felt like one way to leverage the sort of community support and the political will that's been generated around Parking Day was to team up with a partner who could really help us take it national and to connect people with ways to plug into, you know, efforts to create permanent green space in cities. And so TPL is our partner in that regard. When we did our first installation, it was really an experiment, and we weren't sure how people would respond to it or politicians would respond to it. But in fact, San Francisco, we've gotten an incredibly positive response. You know, people said, hey, how can we do more of this?
Every day can be Parking
Day. Every day can be Parking Day.
Did you ever think when you started this that it was going to grow into an international phenomenon?
Not at all. No, we never would have guessed. I mean, it's such a simple idea. And I guess it feels like it's part of a broader movement globally, which is about people wanting to claim the city, claim space in the city, and be an agent for defining how the city looks and feels and functions. I mean, you know, we're starting to think about it as the rate of city remodeling, the rate at which cities sort of change and adapt to meet contemporary needs is far slower than the rate at which, you know, social ideas and our imagination, our collective imagination about the city functions. And so a Parking Day, as well as other events that think of the city as sort of a playful space, allow people to get involved in really remaking their city and demonstrating how they would like to see our cities rebuilt.
For our listeners who want to hear more about Parking Day, is there a website that they can visit?
Yeah, check out Rebar's Parking Day site. It's parkingday.org. You could also check out the Rebar website for what we're up to, which is rebargroup.org.
And Rebar is the arts collective that
yes,
you're
we
part
are
of.
Art and Design Collective.
It's been great having you on the show. Thanks so much. And you've been listening to John Bela from the Rebar Arts Collective, one of the founders of Parking Day.
We're here now with Josie Garthwaite, the Green Living Editor for Sierra Magazine. Welcome.
Thanks.
So today we're going to talk a little bit more about home heating. What are some extra tips for how we can go green this winter by saving energy and also saving some money on our bills?
Right. Some of the tips that I like best are the ones that they don't require me to even go out and buy a single thing. So one of those, you know you can wear layers. You know you can put on a sweater. But how about that ceiling fan? What can that do for you? It's not just for cooling you down when it's hot outside. You can also reverse the direction from what it usually is in the hotter months. There's usually a switch on the side. Most ceiling fans have it now. Set it on the lowest setting, again, in that reverse direction, and that will help push the hot air down. So a lot of homes have the heating vents up near the ceiling, and we know hot air rises, so we don't want it getting stuck up there. So the ceiling fan can help push that downwards, and I think it can make a difference of about 4 degrees. So you can be more comfortable without having to crank up the thermostat just by helping mix the hot and cold air a little more.
So even though it's a fan that we usually associate with the summer months, it can help in the winter months to heat your home in addition to cooling it in the summer.
Right, because circulating that hot air is really just as important as making sure that the room is warm. By that same token, you want to think about what rooms am I not really using during the winter that I can close off. Maybe not just closing the door, but also sealing underneath the door. You can get a sandbag to put there. They have cute ones. You don't have to put just sand there. Put that under the door so that you don't have drafts going out there, too.
I've also heard about using certain kind of heavy drapes to keep the air in at night. Does that work? Does that actually help save money?
It does. It does make a difference because we lose most, a big chunk of the energy that we waste on our heating is going out through the windows. It's going out through the doors. And so using heavy drapes, using plastic over the windows, that can make a big difference.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today. You've been listening to Josie Garthwaite, the Green Living Editor for Sierra Magazine.
We're here now with Emily Green, Director of Sierra Club's Great Lakes Program. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
We hear that you guys just had a big victory, so tell us a little bit about what happened.
We did. We passed the Great Lakes Compact, which is really a precedent-setting interstate compact that guarantees the long-term protection of Great Lakes waters. And the win is the result of about an 8-year campaign that had a number of steps. I mean, we started by working with each of the 8 Great Lakes states. The governors negotiated and then signed a common agreement that laid out the terms of how they wanted to manage and protect Great Lakes waters. And then each jurisdiction, each state, had to pass it into law. And so that has been the bulk of the campaign, actually working with each state legislature to try to pass it into law, into state law. And then it had to be ratified by Congress, and so it had to be passed by the House and Senate, and then signed by President Bush, which it has now been passed by both the House and Senate. He's indicated that he'll sign it soon. So it's pretty exciting because it's actually the first interstate compact of its kind to focus on environmental protection. I mean, other compacts like the Colorado River Compact are really based on using up every bit of, you know, a natural resource. So in the case of the Colorado River, that river, once it has been used by all of the states along it, many years does not actually even reach the ocean. And this compact, the Great Lakes Compact, was based on the notion that the Great Lakes are really a finite and irreplaceable natural resource that we need to protect for future generations. So it's a huge victory. It's been a lot of fun and a long campaign.
And so what kind of protections does it actually provide?
Well, it bans diversions of Great Lakes water, so it will prevent thirsty states in the West and other countries essentially from draining the Great Lakes via pipelines. And this was triggered in part by a proposal to actually ship Lake Superior water via tanker ships to Asia. But perhaps even more importantly, it imposes guidelines on those of us who live here that require the more sustainable use of our own water. So it requires us to implement water conservation and efficiency measures, to set up a permitting system for water withdrawals, and to prohibit withdrawals that would cause an adverse impact on the water resources, so either individually or cumulatively. So basically, it requires that we ourselves are using Great Lakes water resources sustainably, that we're not using more than is naturally replenished. And this is really important because Great Lakes, they seem vast and they're actually 95% of North America's fresh, or United States fresh surface water, but only 1% of that water is renewed every year. So they really are not an irreplaceable natural resource. It really is, it's very finite.
Currently, are states that are not in the Midwest getting their drinking water from the Great Lakes?
No, they're not. But there have been, like I said, there was a recent proposal in 1998 to ship Great Lakes water to Asia, and then there have been discussions over the years to send water via pipeline to places in the West. And most recently, Governor Bill Richardson of New Mexico said that we should build a pipeline to the Great Lakes to feed New Mexico and Arizona, saying that states like Wisconsin are, quote, awash in water. So it is actually a real threat. And particularly as climate change comes and water resources are anticipated to get more and more scarce, I think, you know, it calls on us all to figure out how to live within the means of whatever area of the country provide, rather than just shipping resources like water farther and farther away.
Well, it sounds like a great victory for the Midwest. Tell us a little bit about some of the good news that this means for people in the rest of the country.
Well, I think it is a phenomenal victory, and really it could serve as a model, I think, for other areas of the country to do a similar thing. Like I said, it is the first interstate compact of its kind to focus on the long-term environmental protection and sustainable use of a natural resource, and a natural resource that really defines our region. So, and it's a very powerful tool, because an interstate compact actually has more staying power than a piece of state or federal legislation. It's very hard to take apart an interstate compact once it's passed. So I think it's an amazing tool, and really the standards in the compact could be used as a model for other parts of the country to do the same thing.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today. You've been listening to Emily Green, the director of the Sierra Club's Great Lakes program. This has been Orly Kotel with Sierra Club Radio. To send us feedback about the show or to ask a question for Mr. Green, you can email us through our website at sierraclubradio.com.
You've been listening to Sierra Club Radio, a weekly program of green news you can use. For more information, visit sierraclubradio.com.